Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Undersized Fish Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 25th, 2015, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Yates versus the United States. This case concerns whether Mr. Yates' order to his crew to throw undersized fish back into the Gulf of Mexico during the course of a government wildlife investigation violated the document shredding provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which makes it a crime for anyone who knowingly alters, destroys, mutilates, conceals, covers up, falsifies, or makes a false entry in any record, document, or tangible object with the intent to impede or obstruct an investigation. Justice Ginsburg announced the judgment of a divided court and delivered a plurality opinion concluding that for purposes of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, a tangible object refers to an object used to record or preserve information. Justice Alito concurred on somewhat narrower grounds. Justice Ginsburg was joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Breyer and Sotomayor. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion, which Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas joined. The judgment of the 11th Circuit was reversed, and the case remanded for further proceedings. To discuss the case, we have Todd Bronstein, who is counsel at WilmerHale. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Bronstein.
So Yates versus United States drew national attention because of its absurd fact pattern. An obstruction of justice statute was passed as part of Sarbanes-Oxley was used to convict a man who had quite literally destroyed some fish. And as silly as that sounds, the legal issues raised by the case were never nearly so straightforward. And that was very much in evidence last week as the Supreme Court issued a decision in the case that was closely divided. The court did reverse Yates' conviction, but only by a vote of 5-4, and the fifth and deciding justice wrote that he considered the case a close one. And somewhat surprisingly, to those who witnessed the heated oral argument in this case, the considerations of over-criminalization that this case has come to symbolize were barely a factor in the opinions. In fact, a majority of the justices didn't view the sweeping nature of the interpretation urged by the government as a reason for voting as they did. So first, some background about the case. Mr. Yates was a commercial fisherman who was captain of Miss Katy, a vessel that harvested fish in the Gulf of Mexico. On August 23, 2007, there was a routine inspection by a deputized federal officer of the ship. The officer noticed several red grouper that appeared to be smaller than what was required under federal fishing regulations. Measured the fish and determined that Yates had illegally harvested 72 undersized red grouper. The officer put the fish in wooden crates and told Yates to leave them there and bring them back to port for investigation by the National Marine Fisheries Service. But Mr. Yates told one of his crew members to throw the fish overboard and replace them with larger fish. Later, under questioning, the crew member told the truth and implicated Yates, and Yates was prosecuted for several obstruction of justice crimes. One of the laws he was charged under was the Sarbanes-Oxley provision, which is known as Section 1519. And that crime penalizes any effort to destroy or tamper with, quote, any record, document, or tangible object, unquote, as long as there was intent to obstruct a pending or contemplated federal inquiry. So in this case, the government argued that the tangible object was the red grouper. And Mr. Yates was convicted, appealed to the Supreme Court, arguing that red grouper fell outside the statute. In the opinion last week, the court reversed Yates' conviction over a spirited dissent by four justices. The lineup was certainly unconventional. Justice Ginsburg wrote the plurality opinion, joined by Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Breyer, and Justice Sotomayor. The fifth and decisive vote was Justice Alito, who, of course, is ordinarily among the most pro-government justices in criminal cases. He did not join the majority opinion, but wrote separately to express his views. On the other side, Justice Kagan's dissent was joined by Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas in support of the government. So Justice Ginsburg's opinion for the plurality began by acknowledging the obvious that a red grouper, is a, quote, tangible object under the literal meaning of that phrase. So while a word usage in a statute will ordinarily accord with its dictionary definition, the same word used in a different context may sometimes mean different things. And in this case, Section 1519 was passed as part of Sarbanes-Oxley. That law, which Congress approved in the wake of the Enron accounting scandals, focused on corporate fraud. Given this context, a tangible object under Section 1519 had to be an object used to preserve or record information, and it did not refer to all objects in the physical world, or so Justice Ginsburg and the court held. Justice Ginsburg acknowledged that the dictionary definitions of the word tangible and object were important considerations, but not dispositive. And she pointed to several other interpretive guides that she said pointed in a narrowing direction. First, the title of Section 1519 addresses tampering with records rather than with all tangible objects. Second, Congress chose to codify Section 1519 alongside other crimes that prohibit obstructive acts in very narrow and specific contexts. According to Justice Ginsburg, this was an unnatural place to locate a generalized obstruction statute. Third, Justice Ginsburg invoked the canon against surplusage and pointed to the simultaneous enactment in Sarbanes-Oxley of another law, Section 1512C1. That's a law that prohibits destruction of, quote, any record, document, or other object, albeit only in connection with an official proceeding. Both Mr. Yates and the government had accepted that other object in this statute, in fact, covered every physical object. And Justice Ginsburg said that 1512C1 would serve no independent purpose if 1519 covered each and every physical object. Fourth, Justice Ginsburg emphasized twin canons of construction with Latin names that I am not going to even pretend I know how to pronounce. One canon is that a word is known by the company it keeps, and the other is that a general word at the end of a statutory enumeration takes on the character of more specific words that precede it. Here, under those two canons, a tangible object should be construed to mean something like a record or document rather than anything under the sun. Towards the end of her opinion, Justice Ginsburg did invoke the concerns about over-criminalization that this case has come to symbolize, but she did so almost as an alternative argument. She emphasized the sweeping breadth of the government's reading, 20-year maximum for destroying any physical object that might have evidentiary value in any federal investigation, civil or criminal, pending or contemplated. And she said that under the rule of lenity, the court would need to require a clearer statement before adopting broader reading of tangible object. But she emphasized that this argument about the rule of lenity was only, the way I took it, that she didn't feel it was necessary for the decision. If she didn't view the statute as ambiguous, the rule of lenity is only a tiebreaker, and she didn't view it as necessary, but she included it as a fallback. Justice Alito, as mentioned earlier, wrote a short opinion concurring in the judgment. He stated at the outset of his opinion that he found the question close, but ultimately thought Yates had the better argument. Justice Alito's opinion focused entirely on the text of Section 1519, including basically just a close reading of the section heading and the nouns and the verbs of that section. Notably, he did not invoke broader purposes of Sarbanes-Oxley or the sweeping nature of the government's construction or any of the other over-criminalization arguments that were emphasized by Niki and that were mentioned in the plurality. For that reason, I think it's fair to conclude that a majority of the justices were ultimately not persuaded that the statute's enactment as part of Sarbanes-Oxley or the sweeping breadth of the government's construction should be factors in the outcome. Justice Kagan wrote the dissent. She emphasized that in using the term tangible object, Congress said what it meant and meant what it said. She pointed to a number of other federal and state statutes that use this phrase or the phrase tangible thing, and all of them have been interpreted in line with the dictionary definition of tangible object or tangible thing. Justice Kagan agreed that context is important to interpreting a statute, but thought that it actually cut in the government's direction here. She did point to Section 1512C1, the other obstruction statute that was passed in Sarbanes-Oxley, but thought that it supported the government's interpretation and not Yates's. She wondered how the majority could decide that the very same Sarbanes-Oxley could define other object as everything under the sun and tangible objects as only information recording devices. Justice Kagan also pointed to legislative history indicating that Congress wanted a broad law. She thought that those Latin canons construction also supported the government because record and documents could refer more broadly to the thing that provides information, and therefore tangible objects could have a broader definition as well. Towards the end of her opinion, Justice Kagan addressed the majority's comments about statutory breadth. She argued that they were slightly exaggerated with the statute, but acknowledged that Section 1519 is a bad statute, in her words. Too broad and undifferentiated, and had a statutory maximum that was too high. And she then took it a step further and said that Section 1519 was not an outlier, but, quote, an emblem of a deeper pathology in the federal criminal code, unquote. But, she said, it was up to Congress and not the courts to decide questions about statutory breadth, and thus, 5 of the 9 justices didn't view the larger debate about statutory breadth over criminalization as relevant to their votes. Although Yates is an interesting case in its own right, any discussion of the opinion would be incomplete without mentioning King versus Burwell, the Obamacare case that was argued just yesterday. The King case has some similarities to Yates in that the debate in both is over how much weight one should give to the literal meaning of the key phrase at issue. My thought on this and how Yates might apply is that Chief Justice Roberts is widely considered one of the swing votes in King. And his agreement with the majority in Yates is probably not a good omen for the Obamacare challengers. In Yates, Chief Justice Roberts was willing to sign on to an opinion that emphasized the broader goals of the statute and other factors as a way to overcome the literal meaning of the phrase at issue. He wasn't persuaded by Justice Kagan's argument that Congress said what it meant what it said. And there are surely ways, of course, to distinguish King and Yates. And indeed, based on the oral argument in King, it seems like Justice Kagan, for one, is prepared to do exactly that. Nevertheless, it isn't a good sign that Chief Justice Roberts signed on to a broader, more purposeless opinion, and it may be a signal of what is to come in King versus Burwell. And with that, that's Yates versus United States.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.